Chapter 2, The Battle for the Mind. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. Therefore put on the full armor of God, so that when the day of evil comes, you may be able to stand your ground, and after you have done everything, to stand. Ephesians 6, 12 and 13.
One of the things I enjoy most in life is hanging out with my kids. From the moment I walk through the front door to the time they hit the sack, they challenge me in everything from shooting hoops to playing checkers. Often, I fall asleep with the words, "Just one more game," ringing in my ears. For years, I've had the upper hand, but as my children continue to grow, the scales have begun to tip in the wrong direction. My boys now regularly whip me in basketball, and my girls beat me in checkers more times than I care to admit. One game I still hold a monopoly on, however, is golf. In fact, I told my kids that if they ever beat me in golf, I'd put $100 into their savings account. Well, one afternoon, the inevitable happened. John Mark, who was barely only 9 at the time, challenged me to a putting contest and won. Johnny's ball had barely reached the bottom of the cup when he looked up at me with that mischievous grin of his and chirped,
"Time to pay up, Daddy-o."
But I was ready for him. "How about double or nothing?" I ventured.
"No way,"
Johnny shot back decisively. "How about I give you a 2-shot head start?"
"No."
"Tell you what I'm going to do. I'll give you a 3-shot cushion. Take it or leave it." By now, Johnny was beginning to waver.
"I don't know,"
he waffled nervously. "Come on, John Mark, $200. I'm giving you 3 strokes. How are you going to lose a 9-hole putting contest with a 3-stroke advantage?" I could see that Johnny was beginning to take the bait. "Yes or no?" I pressed, adding a sense of urgency to my offer. Reluctantly, Johnny caved in. 10 minutes later, he was looking up at me with tears in his eyes.
"That wasn't fair,"
he moaned. "Wasn't fair? What do you mean it wasn't fair? I didn't force you to go double or nothing, did I? It was your choice, wasn't it?"
"Yeah, Dad, but you were just like a tempting little devil sitting on my shoulder."
John Mark was not yet 10 years of age, but he'd learned a life lesson far more valuable than $100. Temptation is always crouching at the door. It's as close as a click of your computer mouse and as alluring as easy money. Yet no matter how enticing the temptation, we are responsible for the choices we make. I may have made the deal sound too good to pass up, but in the final analysis, it was still Johnny's choice. Today, John Mark's tempting little devil sitting on my shoulder quip is a classic. Every time one of us repeats it, we all crack up on cue. But there is a serious side. The devil is real, and he tempts us in myriad ways. While we would greatly overestimate Satan's power by supposing he can control us against our wills, an equal and opposite error would be to underestimate his cunning craftiness. Thus, before Paul launches into the covering that protects us against the devil's schemes, he first emphasizes the fact that our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. Translated, spiritual warfare is waged against invisible beings that personify the extremities of evil, and their weapons are spiritual, not physical. While they cannot bite us physically, violate us sexually, or cause us to levitate, they can tempt us to cheat, steal, and lie. Furthermore, it is crucial to note that though the devil cannot directly interact with us physically, he does have access to our minds. He cannot read our minds, but he can influence our thoughts. Thus, Johnny's tempting little devil sitting on my shoulder quip was not far from the truth. Indeed, if we open the door to Satan by failing to put on the full armor of God, he does, as it were, sit on our shoulder and whisper into our ear. The whisper cannot be discerned with the physical ear. It can, however, penetrate the ear of the mind. We cannot explain how such communication takes place any more than we can explain how our minds can cause the physical synapses of the brain to fire. But that such mind-to-mind communication takes place is indisputable. If it were not so, the devil could not have tempted Judas to betray his master, seduced Ananias and Sapphira to deceive Peter, or incited David to take a census. Nor would the Apostle Paul have instructed us to put on the full armor of God so that when the day of evil comes, you may be able to stand your ground, and after you have done everything, to stand. In the final analysis, the whole of Scripture informs us that spiritual warfare is the battle for the mind. Finally, Paul wants us to understand that while fallen angels are not physical beings, just the same, they're as real as the very flesh upon our bones. They're malevolent beings, the vastness of whose intellect exceeds that of any human who has ever lived. Thus, we must not expect that a man unaided from above should ever be a match for an angel, especially an angel whose intellect has been sharpened by malice. From the primordial garden to the present generation, Satan and the hordes of hell have honed the craft of temptation. He knew just what to say to tempt Eve to fall into a life of constant sin terminated by death, and twice the tempter found David's Achilles heel and sent flaming arrows deep into his soul. No doubt, much to his delight, we often depict the devil as either a cartoonish clown with an elongated tail, red tights, and a pitchfork, or as a cultural caricature that traces strange symbols on bathroom mirrors, warns a Christian leader not to expose him in chapel with true little bite marks, or pillages a woman by violating her sexually. Far from being silly or stupid, however, Satan appears as a cosmopolitan angel of enlightenment. In the words of C.S. Lewis, the greatest evil is not now done in those sordid dens of crime that Dickens loved to paint. It is not done even in concentration camps and labor camps. In those we see its final result, but it's conceived and ordered, moved, seconded, carried, and minuted in clean, carpeted, warmed, and well-lighted offices by quiet men with white collars and cut fingernails and smooth-shaven cheeks who do not even need to raise their voice. Rather than brutish, demons are brilliant. Not only do they have an accumulation of knowledge, but as Randy Alcorn notes, they operate within a hierarchy dependent on issuing, receiving, and carrying out orders. They wage war against God, righteous angels, and us. Intelligence gathering, strategy, deploying troops, communicating battle orders, and reporting on the results of engagement are all fundamental aspects of warfare. They live in a spiritual world where there's a certain clarity of thought even among the fallen. The modus operandi is to twist, deceive, and mislead, but they're intimately familiar with the truth they twist. While contemporary Christians are fixating on seven-step programs by people such as Frank and Ida Mae Hammond of Pigs in the Parlor fame, they've all but forgotten the seven steps to freedom presented in Scripture by the Apostle Paul. Satan knows full well that without the seven steps to freedom listed by Paul at Ephesians 6, we are but pawns in a devil's game. Little wonder, then, that since the days of the pilgrims, precious little as worthwhile has been written concerning the full armor of God.